What's up, punks, trenchies, and death clowns? The following is part of an 8-episode series examining the trans allegory of Lisa Frankenstein. Be sure you've watched the movie first. I will not be held responsible for you being spoiled otherwise. Okay, let's go! Welcome to Tilly's Trans Tuesdays. Tilly Vision is back again to talk about the first explicitly trans mask allegory I've seen. Let's dive into the delightful, the weird, the wonderful, unintentionally intentional trans allegory of Lisa Frankenstein, Part 1. This week, context, color, names, and more. Hi, I'm Tilly Bridges, your host, and I'm joined by my writing partner, my best friend, my wife, our token cis representation, the lady whose color can best be described as fire, Susan Bridges.
Hello.
Our guest this week is Kent Eigengrau, a production assistant, writer, and artist who specializes in sci-fi, horror, and all things genre. He spends his free time doing mutual aid, working on D&D campaigns, collecting vintage sci-fi novels, and hyperfixating on various media. He is a transgender man and has a degree in literary fiction and film production, specializing in genre theory and film adaptation. Welcome, Kent.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Okay, so what is this literary fiction and film production? Like, is it like a marriage of the two? Like, how does that work? Tell me about it.
Yeah, so I went to Emerson College. Majors work a little differently there.
Okay.
I was in visual media arts, was my like section of majors. So I went to film school more or less.
Yeah.
And I sort of married that with the more writerly pursuits of things. Like most people going to film school, I went in thinking I was going to be a director. Then I tried it out and found that I liked screenwriting and adaptations and stuff more. So I leaned more into the literary department as well. So I kind of married the idea of a literary degree and a film degree. So I specialized in adaptations and specifically genre stuff. So
that's amazing, especially since we're talking about a media adaptation of a literary work.
Frankenstein and Mary Shelley was something that was like an actual like course that I took.
Wow.
Monsters in Women's Literature was a course that I took. And then I also took a course on classics, women in classics. So like old like Greek and Roman literature, and specifically focused on a lot of like tragedies and stuff. So like women in Greek tragedies and things. So that's a big portion of overlap that I think
you're
gonna
have
find
so
here.
Many thoughts about this movie. I can't wait to hear them.
I will
and
try
I'm
to contain them.
Actually reading Frankenstein right now.
Have you not read it before?
I have not.
Oh yeah, I've read it a few times. It's really good.
I'd never read it before.
Yeah.
So
how exciting for you.
Yeah.
All right. So, Kent, for you, what has been the best thing about transitioning?
I think just coming to understand myself, coming to just enjoy life, finally. That's
right.
I felt like
You'd
I've
think
been
that
waiting
was possible.
For that. Yeah, I felt like that was something that, like, I wouldn't say surprised me, but the instantaneousness of the switch from feeling like I wasn't present in my existence, like always kind of felt like a video game character, sort of off to the side of myself always.
Yeah, yeah.
And the moment I started HRT, like probably 10, 15 minutes after my first shot, it was just an immediately like, oh, I'm present in my body and my life, and this was correct. So,
wow, that's amazing that it happened so fast.
It was shocking. I think some of it was psychosomatic, but
sure.
It was definitely relief.
Yeah, because when I first started HRT, my estrogen, I started on the pills, and they are so much less concentrated than the shots like that I'm on now. And so and they work so slowly, and it was just it's such a small dose that it like I felt nothing. I was like, I'm so excited, I'm so excited. And then it was like nothing, 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 nothing for weeks, and then it finally starts. But I think if I'd had the shots, I might have felt that way because even after being on the pills for a couple of years until they stopped working for me. The first shot I had, oh my God, it was like a world of difference.
Yeah, supposedly there's pills for testosterone, but I've been told that they really mess up like your kidneys or your
Oh,
liver or
yeah.
something, so they
Oh,
tend
dear.
not to give them out to people. It tends to be gel or injectables,
Yeah,
so.
yeah.
But I didn't know that about the pill. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, and it also cannot be great for your liver as well unless you like
Yeah.
dissolve them under your tongue rather than swallow them. So I was doing that, but yeah, they just stopped working entirely, and that was a really rough summer for me to figure out what was,
No.
can you imagine? Like you have this and then you're taking it and then suddenly you're feeling awful and it just gets worse and you don't feel right anymore and your head is all messed up. It was,
Oh,
oh,
wow.
it was.
That's really hard early on, too. Oh, man. Oh,
It was rough.
no.
I mean, that was like 2 years in, I think, but yeah, it was, oh, it was a nightmare. It was terrible.
But we're talking about Kent.
But we're talking about you and this movie. Do you want to let folks know where they can find you online after listening?
I am kind of an old man. I don't do a lot of socials. I am on LinkedIn. Hire me. I'm always looking for work.
Hire
So
Kent. Absolutely. You were
I
the COVID compliance officer on our
Yes, I
film shoot
was.
for Long
Yes, I
Away, and
was.
you were lovely to work with, so
Oh, thank
highly
you.
recommended.
I highly recommend it to work with you too as well.
Aw, it's a love
Hire
fest.
any of us, all of us at
All of us, really. The
Everybody
best,
needs
yeah.
work.
Yeah.
Production is slow lately.
All right. Well, I have done a lot of trans allegory in media write-ups, and they've kind of become what I'm most known for, thanks to the series on the Matrix film that became my book, Begin Transmission, The Trans Allegories of the Matrix. If you'd like to check out all of the others I've done, head to the trans media section of
TillyTransTuesdays.com.
and have a browse. These are easily the most popular essays and podcast episodes I do. You all seem to love experiencing them as much as I truly love doing them. But as a reminder, they are exceptionally more work than my usual essays. Between watching the film and taking notes, turning those notes into this write-up, sourcing screenshots, research, editing, and revising, and recording the podcast version, I put approximately 30 hours or more of work into this, and that's why I can only do them every so often. But hey, the next one is here. Hooray! When I first saw Lisa Frankenstein, I not only loved its heart and humor and its delightful weirdness, but so much transness leapt out at me that it immediately went onto my list of films to do a trans allegory deep dive on. Especially since it's the first trans mask allegory that I've found. Some, like Silo, which as far as I know is an entirely unintentional and was discussed in episodes 36 to 44, and Star Trek Strange New Worlds Ad Astra Per Aspera speak generally about transness. Others, like The Matrix, discussed in episode 26, and Barbie, episodes 61 to 68, and I Saw the TV Glow, episodes 81 to 87, speak even more specifically to trans femmes. So I was really excited to dive into this one for all the trans men and non-binary mask folks out there, especially given the erasure of trans men is a real thing that happens. Listen to episode 14 of this show for more about that. But I do want to say, Lisa Frankenstein, like The Matrix and Barbie and I Saw the TV Glow, still speaks to the entire trans community in so many ways. Okay, Kent, so I wanted to ask you, what was your first impression when you saw this? Did like transness jump out and grab you like it did with me?
I don't know if we're getting into the spoilers about the movie, but there's some very specific scenes in this that
There sure
very much
are.
was like, oh, all right, there it is. Yeah.
Right? But did you find like even like outside of those though, did you find that there was a lot that like spoke to you as a trans man and to your experiences?
I think that there is. I believe that any time you put kind of like a sort of frillier Victorian gentleman on screen. I think a lot of the trans men, there's a common joke about trans names that all trans men have names that are like drowned Victorian boys. And I'm not beating the allegations, my name's from the 20s,
I love that.
but yeah, no, I think that there's some strange fascination with the gothic and like older sort of more sensible sort of gentleman kind of as a character. I think that there's a lot of like hyper masculinity in today's like male representation. So I think maybe that's part of it.
Okay, yeah, I can see that.
But yeah, I think that that was something that for whatever reason fixates quite a lot of us. I think that also just like Frankenstein is like it's a story for outsiders. A lot of gothic monsters and classic monsters always have been. Guillermo del Toro talks a lot about that, about how he gravitates towards monsters. And I think a lot of trans people find themselves gravitating towards horror because of similar things, I would say.
It's interesting that you say that about trans men and sort of like Victorian names, because there was this list that was posted of like the most popular cutesy dog names, and like every trans woman you've met, their name was on that list. Like even mine, it was on there. And I just find that absolutely hilarious that we each have our own little areas that we're sort of drawn. We want the cutesy things and you want the regal gentleman, and it's all just wonderful.
I think your name is wonderful.
Well, thank you. I put a lot of work into it.
All right, so what the hell is an unintentionally intentional trans allegory, Tilly? Well, I'm so glad you asked. This is the perfect timing because I was just about to tell you. As far as I'm aware, no out trans people worked on this film, but in an interview with IntoMore.com, Lisa Frankenstein writer and producer Diablo Cody had this to say about the film's queerness. Quote, "The object of Lisa's affection is literally in a closet for most of the film. I grew up not just in the 80s, but Catholic in the 80s, at a time when people around me were encouraged to repress any queer feelings that they had. And this relationship in this movie is hidden, so I think you can read some subtext into that. And even though it is somewhat of a heterosexual love story, they're definitely an offbeat pair. It's not a relationship that would be fully accepted by society in any era." End quote. From that alone, you know there's an inherent queerness to this film, in spite of its seeming cishet romance. But here's something super interesting, if slightly problematic. The film's director, Zelda Williams, played a trans man in a television show, Dead of Summer, in 2016. Here's some quotes from her in an interview with ETOnline.com. Quote, "The thing I'm most terrified about is the transgender community being insulted by her character, Drew. It's great that the public will get to learn about a male-identifying transgender character as a lead in an ensemble show, but really, more than anything, he is for the transgender community because they don't ever get to see him. I hope that they're happy with him because I'm proud of him." Although she was a bit nervous to take on her first-ever leading role, Williams reveals that in a lot of ways she felt like she could connect with Drew. Quote, "Drew isn't necessarily a far stretch from who I am," she explains. "I'm not a girly girl. I never have been. I had a shaved head for 6 years." End quote. While a seeming cis woman playing a trans man isn't great, listen to episode 4 on trans roles and stories for more on why that is, she clearly got to experience some of what trans men go through in her prep and performance of the role. And that is not to say playing a trans man and being a trans man are equivocal, but actors get inside the heads and hearts of their characters. That's the job. They think about them and explore them in deep and intimate ways. So while portraying a trans man is not living as a trans man, it does give her a perspective that most cis people don't have, especially when she was so concerned about not doing harm and getting it right. A cis person playing a trans character does do harm. Again, listen to Trans Roles and Stories in episode 4 for why. But I doubt anyone involved even realized that. It's part of a long trend of cis actors playing trans characters, even though there are many out trans actors available, especially now in 2025. And from those quotes, she's maybe somewhat gender nonconforming, or at least lived that way for a while. And that also gives her some personal experience with the way society treats you when you don't fit into the very narrow boxes they like to categorize us into. Check out The False Dichotomy in episode 11 of this show for more. So I think when you combine a writer who's trying to speak to queerness subtextually and a director who's intimately familiar with some of what trans people, especially trans men, go through, when you mix those things together, you get them intentionally making a very trans movie, even if they might not have realized it. I've mentioned in many of these allegory write-ups how that's absolutely a thing that happens. Writers and directors and musicians and can often be exploring something subtextually in their work and not even realize that that's what they're doing. For years before I understood, could name, and accepted my transness, I was exploring gender themes in my own writing. There were always perceived men becoming or turning into women. Why would that happen? Nobody knows. It's a mystery. In fact, Jane Schoenbrunn, who wrote and directed I Saw the TV Glow, said it was the process of making their first film, We're All Going to the World's Fair, that cracked their egg, made them realize they were trans. There's a link about that in the show notes. We're All Going to the World's Fair is also a deep trans allegory, which Jane admits was intentional because they were unpacking all of their complicated gender feelings in exploring the theme of the film. But they didn't know that's what they were actually exploring through most of the process, even though they were intentionally exploring it. I was on the Progressively Horrified podcast with other fabulous guests to talk about this film and all the ways it speaks to dealing with gender dysphoria. If that's a thing you're interested in, link in the show notes. This is what creating art is. We tell stories about people exploring feelings and themes that we want to talk about, sometimes without even being able to name or identify what those feelings and themes are. And thus we arrive at Lisa Frankenstein, an unintentionally intentional trans allegory. However, there's some compelling evidence that it might not have been unintentionally intentional at all. Once we get to the end and you have all the evidence, that's something you can ponder. Just remember that everything in a movie is a choice made by the filmmakers. Even when coincidences or happy accidents happen, it's a choice whether to include those in the final cut of the movie or not. There is artistic intent behind it. All right, Kent, before we get into discussing the specifics of the film, what is your take on the intentionality behind the trans allegory of it?
I feel like for so long in like movie history, there's always been this sort of queer, trans, like gay code that we've all kind of had to slip into movies. There's always been those little winks and nods at the cameras, every Disney villain out there being
right?
Very rainbow flavored and various shades. And I feel like we've always tried to sneak ourselves in the ways that we can, because we've always been involved in the industry. We've always been involved in film and the arts and forever. That's just sort of where we find ourselves consistently.
Yeah,
I feel like there's always shades of that sneaking into film, intentionally and unintentionally. This comes up quite a bit. There's so many essays and things out there of, oh, did you know that this character is actually trans, or this character is actually gay? Or, I mean,
yeah.
We need that. We do that. It's necessary, and it's also, I think, cathartic. That it's just something that I think a lot of us end up doing to see ourselves and to also appreciate in different ways of viewing movies. Like we apply lenses to seeing movies. So to queer a film, I think, is something that came up a lot in like my college, like film theory classes about applying different lenses when viewing a film. So there's the first watch you do of a film, just taking the film in. And then the second watch, you apply a certain lens to it. So you can apply a communist lens to it, feminist lens to it, or a queer lens. And that was something we talked about quite a bit. And different films look very different when you apply different lenses to them. Like watching a 3D movie without the glasses on is a very different experience from having the glasses on.
Yeah, that's a great way of describing it.
I think with this film, I see what you mean by intentional, unintentional. There's definitely some happy accidents. And then there's some definite stuff in there where it's like, I don't know if this was them referencing how queer horror and just Frankenstein in general is, or like from other adaptations, like pulling in from so many different movies and so many different horror things.
Yeah.
Or if it was deliberately put in there as like a cheeky wink.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to hear what evidence you have, because I definitely think that what I found and what you found is going to be different. So I'm very interested.
Fascinating. Yes, I definitely cannot wait. But I do want to hit on one important thing that you said, is that so often, you know, we apply these lenses, or we have to tell our own stories even intentionally through allegory, because that's the only way we can get them out there.
Yes.
Even in 2025, like, we have had personal experience with, you know what, you need to pull the transitus in this back. And it ends up being nothing more than allegory, because that's all the people in power will let you get through. And it's really hard to deal with that.
Yeah, I've definitely dealt with that in submitting screenwriting projects to competition. There's always, you can fit in the LGBTQ box, or you can fit in the science fiction box. You can't fit in both.
Yeah,
and that's always tough when it's both.
It's so tough. Yeah, we're experiencing that with our short Long Away, where it keeps getting into festivals that are explicitly queer festivals, or a festival that has a queer category, but it's not getting into like sci-fi festivals.
Yeah,
or just plain,
you need to bring this down
festivals.
To earth more. You need to do a more coming of age story. Do the same coming out story that they always, always want you to tell.
Yeah. It was wild at the Long Beach Q Film Festival, which is a festival full of queer and trans films. And ours ran in the short film block, and we were the only film that had any sci-fi in it. And we were on a panel with them afterwards, and they're like, talk about why did you make a sci-fi movie? Like, it was the weirdest thing. Why would you do this?
Yeah.
You can do both. You can have queer, trans, sci-fi. It's
just
okay.
Watch an old Star Trek episode. It's all over the place. Like,
right?
It's if science fiction can communicate political ideas, can communicate religious allegory, like, genre is another type of lens to apply to a story you're telling. Like, ray guns don't necessarily just mean ray guns. Like,
exactly,
the monster in Frankenstein doesn't just mean that there's a monster there. There's symbolism, there's semiotics in play. There's everything put into the book is both what it is, but also there's metaphor. And everything in there is choice, which I think is also kind of what you're getting at with the film here.
Right.
The semiotics, I think, is essentially what this first episode sounds like you're going to be breaking down.
Yeah, it's, you know, famously, as you said, watch an old sci-fi episode. Famously, that's all the Twilight Zone ever was. It's just allegory for the stuff they wouldn't let Rod talk about on the surface.
So, yes.
Yeah. All right.
We have a rich history.
Yes. Let's get into talking about the film itself. On the surface, it's a Frankenstein retelling about a teen girl who's a bit of an outcast, bringing a dead body to life, making him whole with pieces from other humans and falling in love with him. But just like with The Matrix and Barbie, Lisa and the creature, this is how he's referred to in the film subtitles and is how the monster is referred to.
Wait, they didn't give him a name?
No, he never got a name.
Not in the script?
I haven't seen the script, but in the subtitles, he does not have a name, and he his gravestone very pointedly does not have a name, which we'll talk about when we get there.
Yeah, because I was like, are you sure it's not on the gravestone? I think you went back and checked after.
I've just been calling him Stein in my head, because that's kind of what you could make out on the headstone.
Right, yeah. Well, my theory is, again, that Lisa and the quote-unquote creature represent the same person at two different points of transition.
Oh, wow. That's very different than how I saw it. Oh,
I'm
very
excited.
That's cool, though.
Yes. Okay. Before we go any further, I don't like referring to someone who is, in effect, a trans man as the creature. So for the rest of these deep dives, I'm going to call him Frank. Lisa is a trans man who has denied their truth, like society instructs us to do in so many ways. See Gendered Childhoods in episode 50 and Trans Trauma 2, Societal Gaslighting in episode 95. Over the course of the film, she self-actualizes and becomes who she truly is, Frank, the trans man. It's important to note this movie is not about her egg cracking or realizing that she's trans. This is about someone who did realize, but the world reacted so poorly that she suppressed and denied her own truth, and then coming to realize she cannot deny that truth no matter how hard she tries, and finally accepting it. So Frank represents her self-actualization exactly the way Trinity represented that for Neo in The Matrix. And just like in The Matrix films, the quote-unquote romance between the two apparently cishet lead characters is actually about someone loving themselves enough to do what they need to do in order to be happy, transition, even in spite of society working so hard to stop that.
The point about Trinity and Neo, that's
Yeah.
okay. I'm very excited to see how you're applying kind of the same framework to Lisa
Yeah.
and Frank now. I'm very excited about this.
I'm excited that you're excited. All right. Lisa derives from Elizabeth, which is the Greek form of the Hebrew name Elisheva, which means my God is an oath. An oath is a promise, and though I'm not Jewish, if quote unquote God is love holds true, then Lisa becomes love is a promise to yourself, to love yourself, to be your true self. Lisa's last name is Swallows. Those birds are symbolic of homecoming, very super texty for someone who rejected their truth, but then comes back around to accepting it, but also of the protection and blessing of the divine. And if God is love, the love she has for herself is protected and blessed here in her heart. Swallows can also represent those who know the truth but refuse to accept it. So now it's just super, super text. And if you're new to these, super text is a term I coined to mean the opposite of subtext, basically yelling the truth right in your face. Lisa's stepsister is Taffy, which in terms of names is the anglicized form of Dafydd, which is itself is the Welsh form of David, which comes from the Hebrew name Dawid, which means beloved or uncle. So what the heck is going on there? Is the seeming gender swap of the name important? I submit to you that no, it is not. And in fact, I think the taffy in Lisa Frankenstein has nothing to do with the origins of the name. It is instead there because of the candy. Because what is taffy? It is soft, stretchy, malleable. It can take whatever shape you mold it into. And taffy, the character, is everything society tells you girls should be. Pretty, overly concerned with her appearance, kind of obsessed with boys, ultra femme. She's everything Lisa doesn't want to be. Though the fact that she's someone who should and seemingly does actually care about Lisa, well, until she doesn't, is also important. Lisa's dad is Dale, which literally just means a dale or valley. But what is a valley? A low point that prevents you from seeing what's around you. Dale is perpetually unaware of his surroundings, what's going on, or even how to describe his own wife's appearance.
That was actually really funny.
It was.
Oh, I got a good laugh out of that scene. And also
Yeah.
Taffy is like an interesting character. I found myself endeared to her, even though there's the betrayal near the end.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's she's such a sweet character. A lot, but very sweet.
Dale is also kind of clueless in the way so many cis people are about anything related to transness. Janet comes from Jane, which comes from John, which, okay, here we go. It's the English form of Iohannes, which is the Latin form of the Greek name Ioannis,
Isn't
which
it
comes from
Johannes?
Johann, it probably is. I'm
Johannes.
not, I don't speak these. I'm sorry. But which comes from the Hebrew name Yohanan, and that means God is gracious. But if God is love, why was this name given to Janet, the most cruel and evil person in the entire movie? Because Janet is a hypocrite in every way, which makes her name deeply ironic. Michael is from the Hebrew name Mikael, meaning who is like God or like God. Again, if God is love, then Michael is like love, but maybe actually isn't love, which is important. Not just in what happens with him in the movie, but in what he represents for Lisa. We'll talk more about that when he first appears. As with The Matrix and Barbie, and I Saw the TV Glow mentioned previously, colors are used metaphorically to help tell the story. The single most important color in the entire film is the very specific green blue in the lightning bolt in the opening credits animation. It is the first color you see. It's horribly destructive, and it shows up everywhere in the movie in very specific ways, which I think has to be very intentional for such a wildly specific color. This color is representative of gender dysphoria, of everything wrong with the world when you're not the gender you're assigned at birth. Dysphoria was covered in episode 59 of this show, if you need more info. I tried to find a name for this color, and there are several that get close, but also because things like lighting and paints and fabrics are all colored in different ways, the color doesn't always exactly match. So you're looking for anything close to what you see in that lightning bolt. Trust it will be very obvious most of the time and difficult to miss. Pink, is the color of gender conformity, which makes a lot of sense in a trans mask allegory. It's the color the world forces on girls. And of course, you can be non-binary and like pink. You can be a girl and like pink just because you like it, like me. And you can be a boy who likes pink. But society says, quote unquote, pink is for girls. See that gendered childhoods episode. And so when Lisa Frankenstein is representative of everything society forces on girls and everything that trans mask folks may want to get away from. Yellow is fear and caution. Blue is sadness, despair, and depression. Except for when you see pink and blue together, which is, you guessed it, indicative of transness. Red is more complex and has a double meaning. In the world, it's a sign of danger. But when Lisa is wearing red, it's a metaphor for love. The colors Lisa wears conveys a lot about what's going on with her. When Lisa's in black and going all gothy, well, that kind of garb usually signifies death or honoring death, respecting those we've lost. But as in Tarot, many cultural beliefs and many allegories, death is symbolic of change. The more black she wears, the closer she gets to the change of transition. And conversely, the more human Frank looks, the closer he is to being the fully realized man Lisa has always been inside. I believe Lisa's bedroom is indicative of her subconscious, and Bachelor's Grove is a metaphor for her heart, which, yes, has a dude in it. It's important to note that all of the murders in this movie happen at the hands of Frank and not Lisa, but more important is that each kill is a metaphoric rejection of what that person represents. And just to be clear, though Lisa is a trans man, for clarity, I will use she, her pronouns for her and he, him for her true self, Frank.
I want to circle back to the colors thing.
Yeah,
I'm just thinking now that the entire set of the house, which is like this Victorian-esque style home, is entirely awash with pinks and like pastels. And
that
again,
green blue dysphoria.
Yeah,
color.
And
yep.
Her entire bedroom is all greens and blues, whereas the rest of the house is entirely just pink, like aggressively so pink.
Aggressively, yeah.
It's like overwhelmingly pink at times, especially like that living room set where the family hangs out. Like, I was looking at the lighting the entire time thinking of this is a reference to Giallo films and Giallo style lighting, which is a lot of contrasting colors and using color theory to sort of heighten the sort of horror of certain situations. So you see that in a lot of Italian horror movies, and also like Edgar Wright has used it quite a bit in a lot of his films, of these like really bold, like ridiculous, almost like neon-esque coloration for the lighting in different scenes, especially during like kill scenes or really scary scenes. So you see some of that in here, and I think this film pays a lot of homage to a lot of different horror movies and things. So that was what I was thinking. But again, semiotics, everything means something that you see on film. Every choice is both deliberate and in a way like poetry. You can interpret what you see on your own rather than what the author was saying. So
yeah, exactly. Time for timestamps. Let's go. All right, 0 minutes, 58 seconds. In our opening animation, we see Frank wake with a sigh, and the photo on the wall shows he's alone. His parents disappeared from the photo after he looked at it. Maybe they died, or maybe they're dead to him and he to them because they couldn't accept his truth. Mm. It's actually that second one, when you remember that Frank is Lisa's final form and what happened with Lisa's mom. 1 minute, 4 seconds. The food falls from the spoon. There's no joy. Frank is reading, always reading or playing the piano. He's artistic, inquisitive, soft. Not the stereotype of the manly man, devoid of emotions except lust and anger that the world tries to tell men that they have to be.
Mm-hmm.
1 minute, 18 seconds. The woman blows a kiss at him, giving up her femininity and accepting him. This was Lisa's egg cracking, realizing the soft, artistic guy that she really was. 1 minute, 27 seconds. The pair are together on the bench in black and white, him on the left, her on the right, happy. Frank puts a flower in her hair and she accepts it. This is her accepting his gift, his existence. And look how similar this silhouette of their hair is. Is that because they're the same person? Yeah, I think so. You betcha.
Mm. Yeah, that's wild when you look at it. Like, their hair does look almost exactly the same.
Yeah.
I'm like,
oh, I'll have to look at that. I really interpreted Frank to be sort of the trans man from the beginning, like from his story, separate from Lisa. I was never thinking about intertwining the two. I was reading it as like feeling myself gravitate more towards Frank, of like, okay, this is somebody that grew up and maybe was in like in his time period, like dressing more masculinely, trying to sort of hide the gender assigned to him at birth, and just sort of going through in that sort of old Victorian way of, if I put on a suit and just like shorten my hair, society will just sort of
Yeah.
assume that I am what I say that I am. And then trying to still find love in that society, and having been rejected once that is found out. I think the silhouettes actually show that, like the love interest character in the silhouettes sees like a guitar player that's a lot more like Dorito shaped, masculine, kind of like strong man, kind of like, oh, that's the cool guy with the guitar at the party. Let me go to him instead of the little piano player dweeb over here. That's how I interpreted it,
Yeah,
but
well, that's what I was just going to talk about here is that at 1 minute 36 seconds, the woman leaves Frank when
yeah.
society still treats her like a woman, and you see the flower in her hair has been lost. She's given Frank up, and it devastates her true self inside. 1 minute 49 seconds, the horse kicks a man off the balcony, and metal beams fall and crush a man with a gun on a boat. Masculinity is rejected and cannot fight for itself. Note that in this animation, Frank is always walking from left to right. He was on the left of the bench, the woman was on the right. He is moving from his true self back to the woman society said he was and had to be. 2 minutes, he sits on the bench alone, forgotten, not whole, as a man and woman pair, representative of a trans person who's accepted and reconciled who they are blown away, gone. 2 minutes, 5 seconds, and here our green blue lightning of dysphoria strikes and kills him. The true man inside is dead, for now. 2 minutes, 12 seconds, on his gravestone it says, unmarried. If the metaphor for a self-accepted trans person in this film is a man and woman being together, just like in The Matrix and opposite of Barbie, then being unmarried means unactualized. 2 minutes, 15 seconds. The dirt falls into the grave, and the man inside is covered up and hidden from the world. Her true inner man has been buried deep in her heart, Bachelor's Grove.
Oh, okay. I see what you're building now.
Yeah, okay. 2 minutes, 19 seconds. The woman places the flower on his grave. She is sad to lose him, even though she gave him up to pretend to be who society said she had to be. 2 minutes and 33 seconds. Much later in the future, in the same graveyard, we're in Bachelor's Grove. It's for the dudes. And there's Lisa, the woman at his gravestone in red. She still loves her true self, even if she rejected him. 2 minutes, 39 seconds. A close-up shows that a gravestone reads, Francis Owens. Francis means French. How are Frenchmen seen culturally in the United States? As quote unquote weak or effeminate, artistic, and not quote unquote real men. Owen traces back to two different names in English and Irish, and both mean born of. Here, in her heart, where she has love for the man she truly is, her true self will be born. This is foreshadowing her entire arc and the entire movie right in front of you. Super text. Thanks for being here, Kent.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm having fun.
We'll wrap it there for this week, even though we've only just begun. Come back next week as we discuss what we've buried deep inside our hearts and the horror of being perceived. Tilly Bridges and Transmissions. Tilly's Trans Tuesdays is hosted by Tilly Bridges and Susan Bridges, with audio editing and sound mixing by Jillian Morgan. The written essay version of this week's topic and all past topics is available at tillystranstuesdays.com. Special thanks to Daisy and Jane for the use of Sorry Not Sorry as our show's theme music. Please stop by and show your support at daisyandjane.bandcamp.com and soundcloud.com/daisyandjane. You can find me at Tilly Bridges on Blue Sky and on Mastodon at tillybridges at mastodon.social, and you can find Susan on those at Susan L. Bridges. You can find Jillian at Audio Jillian on Blue Sky. You can join the Tillyverse Discord server by following the link at the very bottom of tillystranstuesdays.com. We hold regular watch parties for the Matrix films and other trans movies, where I do a live Q&A and it's blossomed into a wonderfully supportive, compassionate, kind community of friends. We'd love to have you join us. If you'd like to keep up with all the writing that Susan and I do, you can sign up for our newsletter at birdguestbroadcast.com. If you enjoy this show, please take a moment to leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts. The largest segment of our listeners find the show there, and more reviews equals a higher profile, which means it will reach more of the people who need it. Thank you for your support. For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.
Hire any of us. All of us.
All of us, really.
Everybody needs work. Yeah.